The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, maybe we should start. Yeah? Do you think so? Okay. Hey, can I pass out these things? I always do the promo stuff. Or, yeah, you sure? Okay. Mike, are you going to take notes or surf the web during the class? Whatever. Okay. Hi, my name is Rabbi Edelstein. Nice to see everybody here. I'm very pleased that Jackie asked me to come back and give another little talk here. I want to first, if you don't mind, well, I have an outline of what we'll talk about a little bit, but I'd like to just pass out a sign-up sheet. I like to, you know names of people. I put, if you'd like to give me your email, I would use it for the organization that I co-direct is called Misora DC, and we sponsor programs, classes, Shabbat dinners throughout the city. So if you'd like to know more about that or whatever, or just get together sometime, whatever, give me your email. If not, at least I'll have your name and I can hopefully come back and get to know you personally. I also have some, the flagship program that my organization, Misora DC, does, I would say is the Friday night Shabbat dinners we do at the 6th and I Historic Synagogue, which is a very beautiful facility down at the corner of 6th and I Street. We do these on a monthly basis. We're actually having one tomorrow night. And here are just some cards with our website and stuff and, you know, about tomorrow's time. And everyone here is absolutely welcome. Come check it out. We also, whenever we do that on a Friday night, we also have a Shabbat service Saturday morning followed by a lunch. The lunch is free. There's a fee for the Friday night dinner. But the lunch is free. You're welcome to come by and, you know, hang out with me and my family and the other director of the organization and his family and our friends. We usually get about 20 people at lunch. The Friday night dinners usually have about between 60 and 100 or 120 of grad students and young professionals from the area.
Can I just make one announcement?
Sure. Thank you.
I'm also doing another event called From the Eye of an Israeli Navy Student next month. It's obviously from AU main campus. This guy, Joey Ash, he's a major
you can take one and pass it.
He's recognized in Israel for treating Palestinians with very
Okay, cool. Very nice. Well, it's great to be back, and let me give you out this little outline. I think Jackie does a wonderful job. In my interactions with her, I can see she's a very good and organized person for the Jewish Student Association here. If there's one especially charming habit is picking hugely big topics to talk about. Last time was I suggested them, I guess that's true. But this one she came up with, which was, as she called it, the Ten Commandments and criminal law. And I fired her back an email saying, well, wait, actually, what did I say in that first email? I said, I don't know, whatever. We had a back and forth. How did you come up with that? Do people really think of are the Ten Commandments examples in Jewish law of criminal violations? So she wrote back and she said, you know, because people are somewhat familiar with the Ten Commandments, but there are a lot of misconceptions, so maybe we'd examine them on their own a little bit. And also, what I want to do is use them as a way of understanding more concretely some of the bigger topics. Like, I don't know if some of you might have been here last time when I spoke. We spoke about the oral law, the oral tradition in Judaism, which is a huge part of Jewish law and religion, for that matter. And with the Ten Commandments today, we'll get into questions of how the oral law interacts with the written law, the written commandments. So we'll see where it goes. Sort of an experimental kind of approach. Okay. And my only goal is that you come out with some new ideas, new ways of thinking about this huge topic. We can't cover all 10. Really, they're not 10. That's one of the misconceptions we'll clear up in a little while. They're not 10 commandments, but of what is known as the 10 commandments, I hope we don't have time to go into detail in every one of them, and that would probably be boring, and I don't want it to be just a lecture. I'd like it to be kind of a conversation about, you know, these laws / principles. So I also have as a goal to kind of put these Ten Commandments a little bit back in a Jewish context, because the Ten Commandments have taken on a much larger, more universal meaning, not just for, in the constitutional wars that go on as we speak about, publicly displaying the Ten Commandments or whatever they represent to the groups who want those to be displayed, but just at the world at large. The Ten Commandments probably is, I think if you, I would say, yeah, if you said to, if you, interviewed people from the whole Western world and said, what is the, the brief code of what you would define as universal Western morality, I bet a lot of people would say the Ten Commandments right off the bat. So they take on a much bigger meaning, but we're going to try to put them back a little bit in the context of the Torah, the book of Exodus, the book of Deuteronomy, from which they come, and in traditional Judaism, how they are looked at. Okay, so let's start off with a little philosophy. Maybe the first question is, are these Ten Commandments, that are not Ten Commandments, as we'll see later, are they laws? Are they ethical principles? What are they? What's the difference between a law and an ethical principle? I never went to law school, so I like philosophy of law, though. I find it very interesting.
It's not illegal to covet.
What's that?
It's not illegal to covet.
It's not illegal to covet
in...
In secular, in American law.
Yes.
Very good point. Okay, good. So what's your name?
Ben.
So Ben's saying one thing. He pointed out one of the ten, the number ten, the last one, seems to be about an internal state of desiring something, and that's certainly in, I don't know if there's any legal system, in American law, there's nothing illegal about that. But, Ben, would you say, though, that even in the American, well, but it might be unethical, possibly. Okay, good. The truth is, in Jewish law, we'll see that distinction, but you're just thinking about it and doing something about it plays very much into the understanding traditionally of that commandment. Yes, John, is it?
Yes, John. I would actually say that in response to your question about the difference between the law and an ethical principle, is that a law is the that is enforced externally, whereas an ethical principle is something that is enforced internally.
Okay, John, that's a nice idea. There's an external enforcement, you could say, or you could argue that that's one of the criteria of what makes a law not an ethical principle. An ethical, and you would say an external enforcement means there's some body or with authority to punish those who disobey the rule or whatever, or to enforce it by positive means or, okay. So Ben, besides, we'll go back to you. So besides coveting, what about the other, we're going to read it through, but like, are any of the other Ten Commandments laws? Well, obviously... Oh, it's a great question you ask. Really, the only way to understand... Well, it's thou shalt not murder. The word in the Ten Commandments says, we're not going to do the Hebrew necessarily here. We don't want to. Ritzicha, which is the word that's used, always means to kill an innocent person. It doesn't mean just to cause death to somebody.
Right, but one could say that when you're talking about these pinnacles and benchmarks of Western law, that it wouldn't be necessarily the word murder. It would be, I guess it's more Christianized form, say, thou shalt not kill.
That's interesting. Making a good point in general, maybe I'm not saying, could be that some of those commandments or other commandments have taken on in our Christian culture different connotations possibly from the original ones. Maybe that's a good point. Well, let me ask you this. Now just a technical definition. Civil law versus criminal law. What's your name?
Mark.
What's the difference? And I didn't go to law school, so you got to tell me.
Civil law is between two private parties.
Right. Okay. But it could be obviously a wrong that's an interpersonal wrong, but the society deems it, we're going to enforce it as, okay. Now, this is a dumb question, but can anyone ever be incarcerated for civil law, or by definition, no? Okay. Okay. And the reason I ask is that this will also compare and contrast a little bit. There's different ways of categorizing the laws, the ordinances, the decrees in the Torah. civil versus criminal, at least in the definition we have here in American law, whatever, it's not really such a clear, that wouldn't be one of the ways that comes to mind of categorizing Jewish law. Even though we could roughly say, yeah, that's kind of a civil thing, that's kind of a more criminal thing, but that exact dichotomy or whatever, that is not going to exactly hold up in Jewish law, yeah. Indeed, there was, though. Oh, yeah, sure. For 1,500 years, you know, for over 1,000 years in the land of Israel, where, I mean, again, in history, where the Torah and the edicts of the Torah, and we'll talk about that, there was a judicial system. They were absolutely, some of them were punishable by the most extreme form of punishment as well. You're quite right, though, since 30 CE, 30 of the Common Era, when the High Court was called the Sanhedrin, which was the pinnacle of the ancient Jewish judicial system, when the Sanhedrin ceased to carry out capital punishment, that was preceding the destruction of the Second Temple by about 30 years, but in any case, since that time, these are not enforced in any kind of way, certainly not with those of them which did have a capital penalty. The Sanhedrin gave up that, renounced that actual right to carry out that for different reasons, but when the temple was destroyed anyway, that put an end. That's one of the conditions for which certain things in Jewish law could be carried out was the existence of a temple and all that stood for. So you're right. Nowadays, you're right. These things, at least in the Jewish a rabbinical court doesn't carry out a death penalty against someone who violates the Sabbath. I mean, okay, but good. But you made a good point that certainly. And this, I'll just make this one point, a general point. We'll get back, get more into detail. But even Jewish people often don't, we don't even think in terms that there once was an external system of enforcement and of, crime and punishment or whatever, all the kind of, a judicial and a system, and these laws were part of that system. Now, of course, we study them, we read them detached from that whole worldview because we don't have those, systems at the moment. But that's what I wanted to do a little bit, was bring them back to that original setting. And again, I don't mean to say at all that they don't still represent broader ethical principles. That's one thing I think they do. Even if you're a non-Jewish person, a Jewish person never learns the legalistic technicalities, Talmudic technicalities of each one of these commandments, they still represent broad ethical principles. I think that's why they have such a meaning, for mankind in general. Mike?
I was going to say, if we take it outside the context of just Jewish law,
right,
and we look at the Ten Commandments, the Christian Ten Commandments, or what they mean in Christian society, you can't make that same the same comparison to say that there was a superstructure, because
that's true.
There was never a Christian country, nation, so to say, because it's spread throughout many nations.
That's true.
With their own superstructure.
That's a good point.
It would have had to take a different role in those societies.
Excellent point. That's really true. And that's right. And at least at one time, there really was. I mean, that doesn't mean it was an ancient Jewish society commonwealth that perfectly followed everything in the Torah. We know that the prophets came along to chastise the Jewish people for not always keeping the laws of the Torah. But there certainly was a whole judicial system, which we'll talk a little bit about, going all the way up to what was called the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of the Jewish people. And there was, theoretically, the ability to carry out capital punishment, which we'll talk about. And certainly anyone who reads the Torah, the book of Exodus, especially one Torah portion called Mishpatim, which can be translated as ordinances. That's the section of the Torah that deals, where most of the laws of, I guess you'd call civil law, kind of, and some criminal law, is compressed in that section of the Torah. And many things have fines for certain kinds of behaviors or whatever, not just, and other kinds of punishments. But first we'll just, many of you might have heard this before, but really, there's no such thing in Jewish terms as the Ten Commandments. There's no such thing. Why? Because, in rabbinical language, they're never called the Ten Commandments. What they're called are the Aseret HaDibrot, literally the Ten Statements. And the reason why is because technically, and it's not an unimportant thing, there are really more than Ten Commandments in the Ten Utterances that are called the Ten Commandments. We'll see why, but in other words, some of them encompass individual commandments, more than one, and yes, it's true. There were it is true. Even in Jewish terms, there were two tablets of the law that Moses was given. Five headings on one tablet, five on the other. But we never ever, the sages never called it the Ten Commandments, Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Statements. And there's a deeper reason, I think, which you'll probably appreciate, or maybe, and I hope you would. Why do you think that it's almost deeply misleading in the Jewish context to call these the Ten Commandments?
Because then people might think that there are sanctions for them if they're not followed.
Oh, but there were at one time. Let me be clear. I'm being kind of unclear. They encompass commandments, Jackie, but not Ten Commandments. There's actually more commandments in those Ten Statements than. But I'm just saying, they're never referred to in the phrase the Ten Commandments. And one reason being because the Torah has many, 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 many more commandments than ten. And I think that is just one explanation, but like it would be very misleading for a Jewish person to think somehow these are the ten that are important and the rest are not important. There's absolutely no indication in the Torah of any such thing. At all. Now, you might say, well, why were these numbered singled out for this momentous occasion, the revelation at Sinai, in the context in which they came from? That's a good question. But there are 613 biblical commandments. And so you never hear in Jewish terms saying the Ten Commandments, because it could be misleading. Now, those ten are important in different ways, that's for sure. But there's 10 statements, and technically 13 or 14 commandments within those 10 statements. Okay, and we'll see that as we go through it. Obviously, it's, you know, so it'll be less vague what I'm talking about. But I want to have a general points about. So they are commandments, mitzvot. That's the Hebrew word. A mitzvah is a commandment. Mitzvot. I know it's familiar to a lot of people, but something we talked about last time, which is very important, because I just want you to have a general sense of it, but. Last time when I was here, we talked a little bit about the oral law and the oral tradition. This idea that in traditional Jewish life, this thing called the five books of Moses, the Torah, that wasn't the totality of Jewish law. Far from it. It is like the very, very, very abbreviated notes of the totality of Jewish law. Those notes are called in Jewish parlance the written Torah, Torah Shebiktav. Because it was written down. And traditionally, we Jews have believed that it was written, it was from God to Moses. Moses wrote a complete Torah scroll. That's not the modern academic version of how it came about. That's true. But the traditional view, which I hold by, but whatever, is, you know, that it was a written law. Moses actually, by the end of his life, had a written Torah. In fact, the Torah itself says he copied out the complete scroll of the Torah for each one of the tribes of Israel. And one master copy the Levites would have possession of, or there would be in the temple. But that's the written law. How do you get from a few weird compressed, not weird, how do you get from a few compressed verses in Exodus all the ramifications of civil law running a society? That was all part of the oral tradition, the oral law. The oral law was the detailed understanding and rules of application of the commandments that were jotted down in brief form in the written law. Now, we talked last time about why there's this written and oral component. That was our lecture a little bit last time. And it's an interesting question. But suffice it to say that Judaism never saw the words of the Torah themselves as standing alone. In fact, you can't even properly approach the words of the written Torah without the oral understanding. And we talked about that last time in detail. So many things in the written Torah are either contradictory, not understandable, completely ambiguous, without the filling in of the blanks that was always meant to be part of an orally transmitted body of knowledge. John?
I'm just curious, do you know if there's anything like the relationship between statutes and case law and actual modern Judaism?
Do you
have written statutes and then they're filled in by the background?
Well, that's a good question, John. I'm sure there are some similarities. There probably maybe after we talk a little bit, we'll become clear if it's like that. Certainly, so hold on to that. That's a good question. But I'll give a few examples. So it's a little bit, I mean, it's still a huge topic. And that's the whole relationship between Torah Shebiktav and Torah Shebaal Peh, the written Torah and the oral Torah. But like I said last time, just one example, you know, in a Torah scroll, there are no vowels, there's no punctuation. There are certain breaks but not they're not even chapters. Chapters is a later thing. Now even Jewish scriptures will use the chapter system, but that was not Jewishly, you know, created, the chapter system. The Torah has certain breaks in it, certain passages that are set off spatially in the scroll of the Torah from others, but there's no punctuation. So how to even read the Torah is an oral tradition. That's an important thing to remember. And it makes a great bit of difference, because there are many words in Hebrew that can be read two ways with different vowels. The classic example I gave last time, not to repeat myself, but it says, you shall not cook a kid in its mother's something. And the word in Hebrew is chet lamed vet, which can either be vowelized chelev, which means fat, and therefore there'd be a Torah commandment against cooking a little lamb in its mother's fat, or chalav, which means milk. Same consonants, different vowels. Well, our oral tradition teaches us that the meaning of that verse is chalav. It's a meat and milk mixing prohibition. But I'm just saying, you don't even get to step one without some concept of an oral body of knowledge shaping even how we approach the written words of the Torah scroll. And that's so important. And a lot of people don't, a lot of Jewish people too, aren't aware of how intimate that connection is. And I would just go, we got to get to our topic at hand. That's a problem I have with my own. If my wife was here, she'd be going, get on to the topic already. But that's important that, I know, Jackie, you've even invited my wife to come, but she doesn't have time in the middle of the day usually. But let me say one thing, Mark, for a second. Mark, right? Just that one point that so much of Judaism as a living religion, in fact, it's not a living religion except by means of the oral tradition. Why I wear a yarmulke, why traditionally Jewish women or anybody light Sabbath candles, oral tradition. Not to mention, of course, things like Hanukkah and Purim, which were purely rabbinical enactments that became binding on the Jewish people. That's another category of the oral law, purely rabbinical enactments. We'll get to some of the details as we go through the Ten Commandments a little bit. But I just want you to have a feel for that. You can't, this is not a living religion, the words of the written Torah. Written Torah plus the oral Torah as one unified way of life, that's a living religion. Yeah, Mark.
Okay,
it's easy to get wrapped up.
Passed
down?
And then
okay.
Preserved.
Okay. Okay. So that's a great question, and I can't give you too long an answer of in it. We did it a little bit last time, and if we can get together to talk about that idea. But let me just be, in other words, you know, hold on. The answer to that will sort of come out in here, and then I'll add on to it. So let me just give you one example then. Whenever you deal with any commandment, ordinance of the Torah, law if you want to call it that, of even the Ten Commandments, the more you study, and especially if you study what's now, well, the oral tradition was written down in a form called the Mishnah and the Talmud. We talked about that last time. And then later rabbinical commentaries on those. But the Talmud is essentially the written down oral law. Still needs elucidation, but it was written down as the Mishnah was before it in order at a time in Jewish history when some of that tradition was being lost or in danger of being lost. It really was really an emergency measure to make a book of the oral law, but our sages did so at two different periods. First the Mishnah, around 200 CE, then the Talmud, around 500 CE, was finished. But anyway, so when you study in those sources, you'll see any individual commandment really has a few aspects to it. Let me explain. First of all, you might find a verse in the Torah, thou shalt not murder, or lo tirtzach. That's in the Ten Commandments, as we call them, the Aseret Dibrot, lo tirtzach. But what exactly that means, we look to the oral Torah to understand. It's in the oral Torah that we are taught, or we discover in the Talmud. It doesn't mean don't cause, you know, don't, it doesn't, it means murder. It means killing of an innocent person. So in other words, the traditional understanding of even the basic idea of any commandment was the first part of the oral tradition. And traditionally, we believe that was divinely given from God to Moses. Meaning, and again, I'm aware that modern academic or critical theory questions a lot of traditional beliefs, but I'm just, so the traditional understanding would be, God taught Moses the verse, Lo Tirtzach, and he wrote that down, and that became part of the Torah scroll. But there was a five-hour lecture and more on Mount Sinai, Moses alone, after the public display of the Ten Commandments, he went up on the mountain and he got all the details of Lo Tirtzach, which he then taught orally, when he would teach the Jewish people in the 40 years in the wilderness. And so the basic understanding of those commandments was the first, call it, layer of the oral tradition. But there's more than that, too. Because there are many of the Torah laws were given rabbinical extensions. The Torah sages, what I mean that by that, the ones who either sat on the formal court called the Sanhedrin, and then later, even when the Sanhedrin disbanded, but the great academies of Jewish learning, which were very centralized for a while. It wasn't like scattered all over the world. Babylonia and Jerusalem were the two great, centers of Jewish learning until after the year 500, and Spain becomes important, whatever. But in those academies, the greatest sages of the Jewish people sat, taught, learned Torah day and night. But within the boundaries of what was allowed to them as part of our tradition, they have the ability to extend the commandments in order to protect us from violating them. Let me make clear. The sages, the rabbis, never added new commandments. They didn't add new Torah commandments. The Torah has commandments. They could ordain certain either laws to protect the Torah observance or make certain decrees like Purim or Hanukkah, which the whole Jewish people accepted or whatever. But let me give you an example so it's not crazy what I'm saying. Here's a classic example. Let's take that verse. Lo sevashel gedi bechalav imo, which means don't cook or boil a kid in its mother's milk. That's a commandment in the Torah. Numbers, maybe, Exodus, okay, fine. Well, that's the written verse. Lo sevashel gedi bechalav imo. The oral understanding of that verse, not made up later by the rabbis, the oral traditional interpretation to understanding was, first of all, kid didn't mean just kid, any animal, any kosher land animal, but a kid was the usual way in ancient times. It was a delicious, tasty delight, I don't know, to make a kid in its mother's milk. But not limited to, gedi is just an example, a kid. And its mother's milk, well, what about the milk of not its biological mother? No, that's part of the understanding of the mitzvah. What it really means is don't cook meat in milk when the meat and the milk come from a kosher animal. That, I would argue, that wasn't a later explanation. That was part of the understanding of the commandment. But let me explain, Mark. But later on, were there rabbinical extensions of that? Absolutely there were, and I'll tell you one. Most observant Jewish people wouldn't even think now of eating chicken and milk together, cooked together. But chicken is not basar. Chicken is technically not beef. Beef is really the commandment. But rabbinically, the sages ordained to protect the Jewish people from transgressing the actual Torah commandment. They did what was called a fence law, and they extended the prohibition rabbinically. They never claimed this is a Torah prohibition. No, a rabbinical prohibition of not cooking chicken with milk, and then not eating chicken with milk. Why? Because chicken is rather like meat, easily confused. They didn't make an extension to fish. The most Orthodox Jewish person can have a delicious tuna melt. That's not a problem. Why? The Talmud deals with that. Fish is not, it's not so similar. Yes, there are some thick fishes. Not so similar to basar, to beef, that it's going to be confused. Chicken, similar enough so that the sages in their power extended that commandment to make the rabbinical branch of it, so to speak, not eating chicken with milk. Does that make sense, sort of? And that was accepted. That's part of the Talmud. That became rabbinical law. Yeah. Good, excellent. John, I'm glad you mentioned that. I want you to just keep that in mind. I hope it resonates in some... Yes, I'm sure it is in that way. And even more so, we'll see, because a lot of in practice... Well, you said case law. Really, in practical terms, so much of Jewish law is worked out and applied in a case-by-case basis. Meaning, if you study in the yeshiva, Talmudic Academy, so we study tractates of the Talmud. But if you go to your rabbi, who's an expert in Jewish law, if he is or whatever, and you ask him, you know what, I dropped this fork in my meat, but if you keep meat and milk separate, as many Jewish people do, I dropped this fork in the pot, did I make it non-kosher or whatever? Well, that's a case-by-case basis that the rabbi will adjudicate on, so to speak. But so much of the deeper understanding of Talmudic law was articulated in the later responsa literature of rabbis answering questions, is this permitted, is that permitted, blah, blah. Because generally, as we said, generally, even though now you do have books of, now you do have rabbis kind of writing essays, there's a beautiful website you should all check out if you're interested, jlaw.com. a lot of brilliant rabbis and lawyers writing on like bankruptcy and Jewish law, like a review article. But for in traditional times, and certainly even now, most great Jewish rabbis deciding cases are not writing review articles about a topic. How is the law being applied? Case by case questions. Yeah, Mark. Okay, I know, okay. At one time there was. That was the Sanhedrin. Because by law of the written Torah itself, the decree of the Sanhedrin, 71 of the greatest sages, that was binding. So it was, for a long time, we were fortunate as a people, we had a high court. We did. And that's why, by the way, for most of the time that Sanhedrin sat, that was a period where most discrepancies in this oral tradition were worked out. Because the Sanhedrin had the final say. That was part of Torah law. Majority rule of the Sanhedrin in a case of doubt or dispute. But you're quite right now. It's not so clearly organized, certainly in post-Talmudic times, but that's a good question. Maybe we'll get to that at the end. We're going to get to it. Yeah.
Just the point that I'm a little confused about. Jonathan had mentioned that what you've been talking about is reminiscent of going by cases, I guess.
Right.
I guess what I'm wondering is, like, looking at, like, the modern evolution of equality in the United States.
Right.
Like, Plessy Ferguson.
Yep.
How, you know, at that time the court found that separate but equal was okay, but then Brown v. Board decided otherwise. I guess my question is...
Well, okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, well,
question.
Well, I mean, you know, in our last conversation you had said that, well, you know, you have the... I had raised the question...
Can you overthrow something from before or something like that?
Well, essentially I see... I look at the law and its definition by societal standards as evolving.
Right.
And I guess... I assume you would take the opposite approach. So my question is, how would you reconcile your point of view with what you've just said in terms of Jonathan's assessment of it being case law?
It's a great question. So let's, hold on, I'm not dodging it, but my wife would kill me if she were here. Let's get into the actual Ten Commandments in a second, and we'll try to apply that to what you're saying. But it's a very, very good question. And let me just say, to give the one-sentence answer, definitely the way of applying Jewish law evolves because societies evolve, but certainly that's a big dispute between Orthodox versus non-Orthodox about whether you see can the law of the Torah evolve. The traditional view is no, it can't. I mean, in other words, just to put our face on it, euthanasia, which was Talmudically discussed, I mean, it's not some new topic, is a prohibited form of murder in Judaism. Now, the fact that it has, and again, I'm not being insensitive to the grueling issues involved, but bottom line is it's considered murder in Judaism to actively hasten someone's death, even out of mercy. And that doesn't change, even though now we have so many new technical applications of how to do it, whatever, still that law does not change.
Under that type of context, say Plessy Ferguson went before the...
That's separate but equal, right? Separate but equal is Plessy Ferguson.
Separate but equal is okay.
Yes, exactly, right.
So say that went before the Sanhedrin and they had ruled similar to the court, then essentially that would maintain the way it is under, I guess, an Orthodox doctrine, right?
That's true. And you could say, how could that be? There's a foundational belief that if the Torah is divine, it sort of comes down to that. And that the sages applying the oral law truthfully and objectively with the oral laws guidelines itself come out with what becomes the Ratzon Hashem, the will of God that is,
let me ask you this. Sorry to, like, veer off track. But
No.
Okay, so, like, right now, your opinion on terms of equality, you would say Brown v. Board is correct in this decision, right?
It's so funny. Well, you know what? That's unfair.
I'm
against all forms of racism and discrimination.
Okay,
yeah.
But
discrimination of opportunity. I mean, whatever,
well,
yeah.
Well, okay, I think that's great. But if the Sanhedrin had ruled accordingly, as they did in Plessy v. Ferguson, you're essentially saying that you would maintain that doctrine.
That's correct. I'll tell you.
Even though right now you agree that it's wrong.
Well, it's a good question, Ari. Let me just tell you, I want to find the exact verse. Let me just tell you, though. Maybe I will find the exact verse. The Torah itself very starkly says, I'm not going to find it now, but basically it says, you will abide by the decision of the sages, and it meant the sages in a constituted body like the Sanhedrin.
The judges of your time.
No, that's true, but hold on, okay, right.
That's true, so basically you have to take the judges in a specific societal context,
Yeah, but remember...
It does say...
No, I know that. That's true, but that's... that's, you're taking sort of the verse out of context. The verse means you have to abide by the halachic decisions of the authorities of your time. But part of the oral tradition is those modern-day halachic authorities can't change the Talmudic law decided upon. That was accepted by the Jewish people, by the sages, that was an authoritative statement of the oral law. And that's the traditional view. I'm not going to say there aren't people who dispute that, but that's the idea. So going, what it mean, all it means is, you know, practically means I go to a living rabbi and I say, am I allowed to do this or not? And if he says no, that, and he's a legitimate halachic authority, I have to follow what he says. But he's not allowed to say, oh, I'm changing one of the laws in the Talmud. We don't follow that anymore. He's not allowed to do that. It's interesting, but it's a fascinating topic. I love that idea because I'm actually this Shabbos. If you come on Saturday at the 69 Synagogue, I'm actually talking after the luncheon about some issues of. I'm not a constitutional expert. I don't know anything, but the idea of different ways of interpreting the Constitution is analogous to a question we could have in Jewish law. But the difference is, I'm supposed to sound more like a legal guy here than the rabbi, right? I guess. But the difference is, even those who revere the Constitution don't believe the Constitution was, you know, I don't know, the will of God embodied in paper. Maybe they do, I don't know. But traditional Jews believe that the oral law was divinely given and that, you know, I'm saying that's a... okay. Let's go a little further. Ari, you're asking great questions that really we have to talk more about it. But I just wanted to give you the idea that each commandment then, think there's a root... the basic idea of the commandment, or even we could, you know, the rational reason behind, which many commandments have, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, a rational root behind it, the trunk, which would be the basic outline, but then there could be branches, some rabbinically ordained to protect the trunk of the tree, all the way out till modern day, not alterations, but applications. So it's a beautiful idea, every commandment's like a tree itself, like the Torah in a sense. Yeah. Excellent, John. You're excellent. You're on B. You're moving me ahead, which is great. There are different categories of these commandments of mitzvot, even though they all form one holistic system, as the Torah itself mentions many times that you may do all my commandments and be holy unto your God. But there are categories. John mentioned one: man versus man, interpersonal laws versus man to God. Or sometimes called ritual observances, sometimes they're called that. But very good point. And there are other ways we could categorize the mitzvot as well. Well, and think about it. You know what? You might have heard this, you know, in sermons or classes, but truthfully, the two tablets of the law representing the 10 statements are broken up roughly between man, and man-God. The first five, which we'll see, are really, well, one's kind of a segue, but they're really man to God. And the second five are all between people. So that's a way of categorizing the mitzvot of the Torah. Okay, you know what? Number four, all I want to tell you, number four, if we had more time, we'd do it. But just, there were different courts and different jurisdictions in Jewish law traditionally, just like in American law. I'll just give you a couple of examples, right? Most monetary cases, all monetary cases, could be heard in ancient times by three rabbis. Now, they had to be ordained in a specific way. I'm ordained now. It's not the real ordination. Real ordination was a direct transmission, generation to generation, Moses to Joshua and on, and involved the symbolic, actually, like laying of the hands on the head of the person who was ordained. That was a very specific thing. It could only be done in the land of Israel, whatever. So there are kind of conditions around it. But suffice it to say, for, you know, if what's your name?
Luis,
if me and Luis were having some dispute, or my ox gored his ox, or I punched him, I lost my temper like I shouldn't do, whatever it was, for non-capital cases, we'd go through to a court of three sages who were ordained. Okay, for capital cases, three was not enough. You needed a court of 23. Every district or city in the ancient land of Israel had a supreme court of that district. There were 23 sages. They could try capital cases. Certain extraordinarily difficult cases that the more local jurisdiction couldn't go, they went all the way up to the 71 Supreme Court in Jerusalem, which was housed right next to the Temple Mount. And there were 71 sages on the Sanhedrin. A couple of other points. Again, I'm just scooting the surface, but You might know, and, you know, my father-in-law is a lawyer, so I would never say anything against lawyers. I actually have a lot of respect for lawyers. But in Jewish law, there's no lawyers. In traditional Jewish law, it's more like, I guess, I don't know, European system or British system. The judges themselves ask the questions of witnesses, etc. And in the Talmud and the Mishnah and the oral tradition, there are many, many details we're not going to get into on. What's a valid witness for a Jewish law case? Can't have relatives. Different laws. The different kind of questioning the judges do. There are a couple of tractates that are all about those kind of procedural things in Jewish law. They're interesting. And different kinds of punishment. Well, we'll get to that when we talk about the Ten Commandments. There was capital punishment. And we'll talk about, well, yeah, when we get to it, let's get a little further in, and we'll talk about that. Okay, so there are two places in the Torah, in the five books, where we have these things called the Ten Statements. So let's look here at the first one. I'll read the very first part, and then I'll call on someone. I only want to put it a little bit in context. If we just go right to, I am the Lord your God, okay, we're just looking at these laws in a vacuum. But you know what? There's actually a Torah commandment, one of the 613 biblical rules, laws, to remember the actual giving of the Ten Commandments, meaning the setting in which they occurred, as the book of Exodus tells us. God speaking, a fire on the mountain. I think that's a Grateful Dead song, Fire on the Mountain. Anyway, okay. Anyone like the Dead here? Is there Fire on the Mountain? Anyone know? My wife knows that kind of thing. Okay. So here's the background to it. Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, this is what you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel. Okay, you have seen what I did unto the Egyptians. This is 50 days after the Exodus from Egypt. Now therefore, a few days before that, but if you will hearken unto my voice and keep my covenant, all the laws, including these first statements that are going to be given, were part of what was seen as a historical covenant between God and the Jewish people, then you shall be mine own treasure from among all peoples. You shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, which means teachers, spiritual leaders, people studying and keeping the law, and a holy nation. Okay, that's an important preamble to set the tone of the enormity of these, the statements they were about to get. Okay, and Moses came and said, do you like this deal, everyone? And they said, yeah, we like the deal, we're going to go for it. We were very enthusiastic about it. Okay, and then turn the page. Came to pass on the third day, there were thunder and lightning and a thick cloud upon the mountain, the voice of a shofar, exceedingly loud. Okay, and all the people trembled. I just want you to put the context of the Ten Commandments, as I'm sure you all know, probably from Hebrew school, Bible school, it was a very awesome public revelation of the law, as we call it, right? And that's important. Moses later learned the details by himself, but the Torah itself says, God said, every person has to hear my voice to know that I exist, and or to know for sure that prophecy is something real, and that when later on Moses teaches you the Torah, you won't question, well, I don't even believe he's imagining all it. So our tradition as a Jewish people is that every Jewish person at Mount Sinai heard God speak. If not all the Ten Commandments, the first two. There's a disagreement about that in the oral tradition. But anyway, okay. The mountain was pouring with smoke. The Lord descended upon it. Okay, now let's go down to the actual verses. Mark, would you read for us? Hold on for a second. It's great. I apologize. I was looking online. I was trying to find just a more modern translation. But any physical representation of God, that is prohibited. Keep going.
Okay. For that is in water. Yeah. Thou shalt not bow down unto them nor serve them, for I am the Lord thy God, and the jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the father upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. And showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain.
That's okay. Actually, someone else. Luis, want to keep reading?
Sure. We're on 7 now?
Yeah, 7. That's a verse number, not an actual number of commandments. Bye-bye. Take care.
Okay. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath unto the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any manner of work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day, and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou
Mark,
shalt
take
not
it,
covet
we'll talk
thy neighbor's
me.
Wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's.
Beautiful. And all the people perceived the thunderings and the lightnings, and when the people saw it, they trembled, they stood afar off, and they said unto Moses, speak with us, and we'll hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. That's the basis for the idea that, whatever, in the oral tradition it discusses, after the first two commandments, it seems like the rest of, except that we were a little bit freaked out by the intense prophetic holy experience, and wanted the rest to continue between God and Moses, and we'd overhear it, but in any case, that's the first time in the Torah. There's one other time in Deuteronomy, which we'll read in a little bit. That's the description of the mountain, Mount Sinai, this public revelation, and the Aseret HaDibrot, 10 statements. Okay. So, within those, turn over the page, and you don't have to read them aloud, but look, you'll see. Now, there are discussions among the early authorities about how to number the biblical mitzvot. And there are differences of opinions. Maimonides sometimes, in the way he numbers, there are 613 basic biblical commandments. But sometimes the early authorities disagreed on how much you compress certain verses into one mitzvah, or are they really separate mitzvot. It's not important so much, it's technical, but like that's why most people, most authorities say there are definitely more than 10 in those 10 statements I just showed you here, because let's call one, and each one we'll talk a little bit about, belief in the existence of God, belief in no divinity besides God's. Everyone agrees those are the first two. Now, the first one is not even in the form of a commandment. I am the Lord your God. All right, we'll talk, okay? I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In our oral tradition, that's enumerated and understood as a commandment of belief in the existence of God. Not just an abstract belief, but a belief that God is our God, who has a relationship, a historical relationship with the Jewish people, took them out of Egypt. It wasn't some accident of historical forces. He took us out. So there's a lot of details even to what it means, belief in God. But that's number one. Number two, lo yeh lecha, that's in Hebrew, you shall not have any other divinity besides me. But here, I put in parentheses, not making a graven image, not prostrating oneself, not worshiping an idol in its usual way. Some of the authorities really put that all as number two, and not as separate mitzvot. But that's, you know, a technicality, really. Others say, no, they're really separate things. Bowing down is one form of worship, specifically mentioned, hishtachaveh, and one is other forms of honoring a graven image or whatever. John?
Is that a prohibition against representative art?
Okay, great. No, not really. It's a good question. Not representative art, as when you get to the category of sculpture, there's an issue in Jewish law of trying to make some perfect representation even of something of this world, like a person. But it's not an outright prohibition, certainly not a painting or anything. No, the specific application is really a representation of something in order to be worshipped, as something that will be looked on as either a partner with God in creation, like the sun and the moon or whatever, or itself a deity. But you're making a good point. Even though there is a rich history of Jewish art, sculpture it's not. And that part of it was because, not that you can't make sculpture, but there are more details about, in Jewish law, lest it even as, it wouldn't even be necessarily, and I'm speculating here, I don't know the topic in depth, but it could be it's a rabbinical extension of the actual law. Meaning, even if you're making a figure of a human just for aesthetic pleasure, it could be if it's molded to be lifelike or too lifelike, it's a problem in Jewish law. It is in some ways. I don't know the details, but that's a good point. But there's nothing in Jewish law as well as pictures or paintings. I mean, the truth is what? It's discussed in the Talmud as well. It's tracted in the Talmud. I'm not sure. If you say this is a painting of what I think God looks like, that's a problem, obviously. That would fall under, even though it's not a graven image,
I believe it would be, well, again, that would be the kind of detail that the oral law will take up in the Talmud. The whole, yeah. Yes, I know. So that's, it's a good question, and it's worth looking into. It's an interesting topic. I don't know the details of it. That's definitely true. Let me say one quick thing about this. Some people can get freaked out, and there's so much in the whole Torah about idol worship. All I would say to that is that we don't have in our day I'm not saying that there aren't human beings on earth today who, there are certainly pagans, there are certainly people who are polytheistic, and maybe their form of worship is, some of them, really like in some way ancient idol worship. But I would just say to you, we're kind of remote from really understanding that close relationship between early mankind and idol worship, and it was a powerful force. Our sages even say that you know, even in their times, it wasn't in existence, so to speak, like it was in earlier times. So we can learn much from even those commandments, but of course, someone can say, well, all these details about bowing down to idols, that doesn't affect us. You're right in a certain way. It doesn't mean that they're not ethical principles involved, there certainly are, or that it's not interesting to study and important to study the law on its own terms, but I'm well aware that, you know, part of the Torah does deal with certain commandments that are not as applicable to our daily life and belief system, certainly when it comes to directly worshiping an idol. Yeah. Okay, good. So what Robbie's saying is not just like a poetic flourish. It's really part of the commandment, because if you look at the wording, it's only after the verse says, you shall have no other gods before me, then it says you can't make a graven image or worship it. So the commentaries from the oral tradition say, you're right, Robbie, there's an aspect of thought involved in that commandment, of an inner orientation to looking on anything in this world as being the source of our ultimate hope and not God, so to speak. So you're quite right about that. It's not just poetry, that's part of the mitzvah itself. So that does apply to modern times, meaning if someone, you know, internally, not even doing an action, would say, you know, well, you know, I serve the so-and-so, I don't bow down to it, but I believe in my mind that, you know, I don't believe in this God thing, I believe in some other thing. That would be a form of idolatry in a sense. Now, there was no capital punishment for thoughts. Okay, that's an important thing. Capital punishment in Jewish law was only for actions, and there were very specific guidelines. Very hard to carry out actual capital punishment in Jewish law, as we'll see in a second. But it's a serious thing in the Torah to even contemplate another force of creation or being who is either a partner with God or the replacement of the Lord God. You know, that is a serious thing, but it wasn't punishable by if someone in the privacy of their own thoughts, there's obviously no way to punish that. God himself could punish it, I guess, but I mean, not the human court. Okay. Not, and I put stars by the ones that were potentially capital punishment crimes. Not to prostrate oneself in idol worship. Okay. But anyway, so what do we get? Belief in the existence of God, and that means a negative consequence of that. No other divinity besides God. What we colloquially call number three is six, not to swear in vain. Not to take the Lord's name in vain. That's the third one on the tablet, so to speak. The fourth one is to hallow the Sabbath. Actually, the verse, well, I'll explain something in a second. It has to do with the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath. That's the fourth one. And the fifth one is honoring mother and father. That's the first, if you see, you know, the first tablet, the first five, belief in God, no other God but God, not taking his name in vain, remembering or hallowing the Sabbath, and honoring mother and father. Those are the first five. Okay, let's go through, and the second five, they're much more straightforward in a way, not to murder, not to commit adultery, not to kidnap. See, here's an interesting thing. Even though that's often translated, thou shalt not steal, the oral tradition says, no, there are many other times in the Torah where we're told about not stealing someone's articles. It's a prohibition that appears in different forms many times. The specific prohibition of the Ten Commandments technically is really not stealing a human being and selling them. And how do the rabbis know that? Well, that was part of the oral tradition, and it fits in context because everything on, it's right in the middle of other crimes that were capital cases. Murder was a capital crime in Judaism. So was adultery. So why would it stick, don't steal, right in the middle of two capital crimes? That's an indication that it's on the same level in this particular part of the Torah as those two, which is stealing of another human being, and then actually selling them. But anyway, so that's an example where a traditional Jewish person benefiting from the oral law, it doesn't mean just stealing. Even though, don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful principle that we should hallow, don't steal, right? And the Torah is full of not saying not to steal. But that technically, we're taught traditionally means not to kidnap. Not to bear false witness, and finally not to covet what belongs to somebody else. Okay. Questions or comments about anything what we've talked about regarding the commandments, and then we have a few minutes. I want to give you an overview, a beautiful way of thinking about how they go together, and then we can go. I want to go, with time allowing, for 5 minutes. Anyone you want to go into a little more detail, or ones that I'll try to show you or talk to you a little bit about what the details of that commandment are. Yeah.
I have a quick question. The number 8 on this list.
Yes. Correct.
If we look at it from the perspective of Jews and non-Jews, can a Jewish person make a non-Jewish person do work for him on the Sabbath?
Excellent question. Excellent question. So there, the general answer is no. A lot of Jewish people have this wrong impression that, you know, oh, I'm prohibited from doing certain activities. I'll ask my Gentile friend to do it. You can't do that. There is a certain application in, it's a whole area of Jewish law, what a non-Jewish person can do that a Jewish person can benefit from on Shabbos. But it's, you can't just say, hey, go light the fire for me. You can't do that. But it's a good point. And that's part of the, there are times when it is allowed, but it's an interesting part of Jewish law. Yeah. No, no, and that's why you can't do it. But see, here's a good point. But see, John, that's where within the oral tradition articulation of these commandments, that was part of the thing, that there was, how can I say, exceptions built, just like a law that's made today. Let's try to use an analogy. I wish I had done that more, but just like any law today articulates a principle, but built within it are exemptions. Maybe they're articulated, or maybe they're implicit. That's true of the Torah commandments too. So even, you know, so like within that giving of the commandment was the articulation of when and how someone could ask a Gentile to help them do something they're not allowed to do on Sabbath. But the simple answer is no, they can't. Okay.
I have a
yes, Barbara, sure.
Coveting
thy neighbor's stuff? Excellent. Okay, excellent question. Well, to jump ahead, or not to jump ahead, if you look, we won't read them all, but as many of you know, the book of Deuteronomy is, we traditionally understand it as Moses' restatement, so to speak, of the Torah. It's in the form of his speeches to the Jewish people. Now, we believe then God dictated to Moses at the end of his life, including what he said, or the essence of what he said in the Torah, but it started out, so to speak, as Moses' master lectures to the Jewish people. So when he's recounting their history, he repeats the Ten Commandments, adding or changing certain words for important reasons. So what Barbara said is a very good point. In the book of Exodus, when God's speaking directly, all it says is, thou shalt not covet what belongs to thy neighbor. In Deuteronomy, it says, and I put it, oh, you know, I don't think I highlighted it. Yeah, I did. It's in the very back of the page here. Neither thou shalt thou covet thy neighbor's wife, neither shalt thou desire what belongs to your neighbor. So let's take this for a second, since Barbara was interested. There's really two separate commandments in the enumeration of biblical commandments. One is coveting, one is a covetous desire, which is separate. What do I mean? Some say it's really the same thing, but your first question was very good. It's a little complicated in Jewish law, but there's really two categories. The narrower, let's be like constitutional, right? The narrower reading of thou shalt not covet, which is important in Jewish law, is not just thinking. It means a thought that leads to either a contemplated or an actual done action. Meaning, I want your sweater so much, I'm going to try to pressure you to give me your sweater against your will. That's the more narrow reading of coveting. In other words, it's not just, but then in Deuteronomy, we see Moses, when he repeats the Ten Commandments, he adds the idea of desiring. So that's a big discussion in Jewish law, whether the desiring is strictly coveting. You're certainly not supposed to, you know, dwell on your desire for what belongs to your neighbor. That would be the desire. But the narrower reading, Barbara, really is something that leads to an action. And the Talmud goes through examples. The classic example of coveting is, like I said, I want what belongs to you so much that I'm going to pressure you, even though you agree, not stealing it, that's stealing. I pressure you really to give in when you don't want to. Or another example is, I take it from you and I give you the money. I force you into it, but I give you the money anyway. That's the narrow that's coveting, that the classical form of coveting, which is interesting. Again, there is an aspect of just that desire, the obsessive desire that is part of it, or perhaps a slightly different branch of that thing. But it doesn't mean, coveting does not mean, I like Barbara's sweater. Barbara, where did you get that sweater? Oh, I got it at TJ Maxx. Okay, I'm going to get one for my wife. That's not coveting. Coveting means I like that sweater. I want her sweater. And I'm going to try to get her sweater right for her. Try to sing it out. But that's an important thing. You know what I mean? Being jealous is not a good trait, but coveting has a, like everything in the Torah, it's a beautiful idea. There's an ethical core, which is important, but there are also the specific guidelines. That's one of the beauties of Judaism. It's not just an ethical principle. There are guidelines of what is the, you know, legalistic, if you will, on how that plays out into action, whether it's a violation or not. And that's an interesting point. Let me take one example, and of course it's an endless topic. A couple things. We'll stop at 1:30, but 1:25 should we stop at? 1:20. Okay. Let me give you one other couple things, and I'll end, it's okay, with a big perspective that I think is a beautiful idea that one of the great commentators says. But let me give you an example. It sounds almost funny, even though it's a serious topic, but I mentioned rabbinical law before, and its relationship with Torah law. Well, there's a Torah commandment not to bow down to an idol. It almost sounds funny, but you know, the sages extended that in certain ways. They said, it sounds funny, but a person should not even bend down to tie their shoe in front of the idol, because it might look like they're bowing down. Sounds silly almost, not silly, but that's an example of a rabbinical extension. If someone tied their shoe in front of the idol, they're not breaking a Torah law, but they might be violating a rabbinical extension because it's close to an act of worship or veneration. That's an example. Really, okay, a couple other things. The Sabbath, maybe we'll have a whole, people might not be interested, but perhaps in a future time, we can take, Sabbath law is so interesting because you see all the principles at work in the way we understand orally as part of the tradition, what work means. That's defined very concretely in the Talmud. It's not just anything I think is work or labor. It's a definition, a creative activity, a form of creative activity, very clearly defined in the Talmud of what it is. So that's an example where you know, without that, it's so arbitrary. There's a good example when I teach about the oral law to people, I say, like, there had to be. If people say, Rabbi, I don't even know if I believe there was an oral law. That's a later invention. But hold on then. But then every person reading the Torah can interpret work in any way they want and say, you're not allowed to do it on the Sabbath, and I'll get you stoned, you'll get a death penalty if you do it. But it couldn't be. There was a clear definition of what milacha, and actually milacha doesn't mean work. That's a modern translation. Milacha can't be translated. It means creative activity. It's actually similar to the word malach. Malach is an angel. There's an interesting connection there. Whatever. But I mean, okay, just a couple things and we'll finish. Honoring your parents, a very beautiful principle, whether one's a Jew or a non-Jew, of course. But in Jewish law, that honoring takes on very specific acts. What does the Talmud explain, the oral tradition? Feeding your parents, clothing them if they need it, attending to their needs. Now, there are very legalistic discussions in the Talmud. What if you're poor and your parents rich? Do you have to pay from your money to feed them? No, that's discussed. Those are part of the details of the oral law, and they're actually important. Again, I mean, the principle is a beautiful one, whether one gets into the principles or not, the legal ones. But those are questions. Or what are the limits of honoring your parents? What if your parents are terrible people? That's all dealt with in the oral tradition, stuff like that. One obvious point, and the Torah even hints at that, if a parent tells a child to do something in violation of the Torah, they're not allowed to honor them. That's not part of honoring your parents. Why? The Talmud says, because they're obligated to honor God just like you are, and God comes before your parents. So therefore, murder, that means, Mark had mentioned it before, you're allowed to kill in self-defense in Judaism. That's not lo tirtzach. Lo tirtzach means killing an innocent person. In fact, You're absolutely allowed. We once talked about that, I think, about killing in self-defense. It's not considered murder. Okay, that was part of the oral tradition. Yeah.
What if your parents told you if they're being kept alive by...
Okay, great question, Jackie. That's such a hard issue, and I don't want to dodge the topic, but when you talk about like an end-of-life kind of issue and all of those things, so that's complicated. Let's put it this way. We will. I know you'll get me back. I'll come back if you want me back. But certainly, I mean, classic, if your parents say, you know, whatever, go tell a lie to this person. You can't do it. You know, part of honoring is not saying, go jump in a lake, mom, dad. There's a way, honoring is addressing them even in a respectful way, but you're not allowed to listen to them if it contravenes something in the Torah. But anyway, let me leave you with this one beautiful thought, just at closing. And there's a lot more to talk about, of course. But Rabbi Hirsch was a great commentator in the 19th century, beautiful Samson Raphael Hirsch. And he says, if you think about the structure of the, quote, Ten Commandments, of these statements, there's a really beautiful balance and a real progression. I'll just leave you with this. If you think about it, the first one's certainly the most important, actually. It's the foundation of them all. I am the Lord your God. A recognition that God is real. He plays a part in our lives. He's not some abstract deity. He is your God who took you out of Egypt, who's involved in your lives. So Rabbi Hirsch says, all the ten are a branching off, so to speak, of that root recognition. Why? The negative consequence of that is you shall have no other gods before me. Because a true recognition of God as the one and only deity means he can't share the stage with anybody. That's number two. Number three, you shall not take the Lord God's name in vain. What's an oath? That's another thing that's a little bit archaic. But in ancient times, people, I guess more often, would take an oath to commit themselves to a certain behavior or whatever. Well, if you yoke God's name, his holy name, the awesome God, to a false oath or a meaningless oath, thereby taking the holy recognition of God and cheapening it, that's what it means, not taking God's name in vain. And that really is a symbol of cheapening God's name in kind of all social interactions. You're calling God for a false oath you're going to make or whatever. Four, keep the Sabbath. The only way that for mankind this recognition of the one God could be preserved is through an institution, a regular institution, about commemorating that idea. That's what the Sabbath is. We testify that God created the earth and that we're stopping our own creative activity for one day to testify to that fact. Number five, this recognition of God's oneness would never get passed on if there were not respect between the generations. All of Judaism is built on fathers and mothers teaching their children. That's, we all Jews know that. That's honoring your mother and father. And then, very beautifully, Rabbi Hirsch says, the second five are starting with the realization that just like I have an obligation to recognize God, every other human being that I look at in society is also created in the image of God. And I have to honor that recognition in the actual person of my fellow man. And the Ten Commandments, so to speak, mention the most fundamental ways you would violate that. By taking their life, by taking their spouse, by stealing their bodily freedom, kidnapping them. And whatever. So it's a beautiful, and then he says very beautifully, just like the ten statements began with a thought, it ends with a thought. Because even though coveting does have that action part of it, it also is really an internal thing. It begins with the coveting feeling. So you sort of go from thought to speech and action back to thought. And he says it's very beautiful. It really connects together. And the message of that is that Judaism is not just nice abstract ideas, but it's also not just mechanical physical actions. You need both. You need the recognition of God as the one and only creator and guide of our lives. It has to translate into real life words and actions, but then you can't lose the forest. You have to always have the forest and not just the trees. It has to always go back to an internal feeling of, you know, that God is real. And if you think about it, yeah, the integrity of another human being is such that, it's really an amazing thing the Torah expects of us, but the integrity of another, of course, not killing, we understand, but not even to dwell on thoughts of wishing that you had what your neighbor had. Why? Because that belongs to them. Again, it doesn't mean you can't be inspired to go out and get the same Lexus they have, but to some way resent in your mind that they have that certain thing is also a violation of another person and of God. That's why it ties back to number one. Because if you think about it, if you really believe I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, I'm a personal God, I deal with you, then what belongs to your neighbor has no connection to you. It's his, not mine. It's hers, not mine. So, okay. Thank you for staying. Thank you for your...
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.